The girls introduced themselves to me as I nodded with embarrassment, and when the bus finally came, none of the girls sat next to me. That's where I met Monique, who still reminds me of that pitiful introduction. I never would have imagined that a year later she'd be accompanying me to the Dance of Doom. She echoed everyone else's excitement to see me dance. I half-heartedly played along. Yeah, I'm pumped. 20 minutes later, it does take at least 20 minutes to get anywhere in L.A. We made it to the border of Carson and Compton, where LaCura resided. My butterflies kicked in as I stepped out of the car and waved goodbye to Monique's mom. We were led to the backyard, where a cluster of sophomores in jean outfits and bright colors bobbed to loud music. It was a nighttime version of Mac 10's Backyard Boogie. The absence of alcohol from my entire high school experience was both a blessing and a curse. A blessing because we managed to have fun, amazing bonding experiences without alcohol, which made the experience I had in college with alcohol that much more special. And a curse because that means every embarrassing thing that I did was a result of being completely sober. That's a sad realization. As Monique and I went around the outskirts of the party, acting as if we were excited to see people we had seen just the day before, my eye kept wandering to the patch of grass in the center that had been labeled the dance floor. Optimistically, I thought I might actually get away with spending the entire evening socializing. The dance floor was empty and nobody was paying attention to me. If only I were so lucky. Out of nowhere, Maurice, one of the cutest guys in our class, approached Monique to dance. Her playful resistance caused a scene as he dragged her to the center and started working her while people watched. All the uh-ohs and get-ems caught LaCura's attention and brought her next to me as she watched the scene with glee. She turned to me. You ready to get down? You next. On cue, having finished being humped by Maurice, Monique yelled out, Get Joe! Get Joe! The crowd still watching, Maurice shrugged and pulled me to the dance floor. Monique, LaCura, and the rest of my sophomore peers watched as Maurice moved behind me and Trina's nasally vocals serenaded us. I had to back up all the talk I had spewed in the last 2 weeks, and so I stiffly bent my knees, booty popped, or back popped if I'm being honest, and swayed to the best of my ability. I heard laughter and general aloofness. Determined to make an impression, I swung my braids back and dropped to the floor on all fours, arching my back in the literal bad bitch position. My hands on the ground, pumping my butt to the beat, I heard the cheers, the gasps, and the laughter behind me. And then came the flash of cameras. My heart stopped. The flashes could only mean one thing. Someone was going to capture this moment and share it with others to further humiliate me beyond this evening. Because what could be more humiliating than feeling compelled to get on all fours just to gain social credibility? When the song was over, I got up, ashamed and mortified on the inside and yet boastful on the outside, as Maurice moved his humping elsewhere. Monique approached me, dying of laughter. I got that shit on camera! I don't remember how long we stayed at the party, because I kept replaying that moment over and over and over again, wishing I could be teleported to the future when all was forgotten. I was so afraid of what was to come. Relieved the party was over and that the truth was finally out there, I still had to deal with the consequences the following Monday. I started to think of the excuses I could give. Maybe I could blame their inevitable lack of appreciation of my dance moves on cultural differences. That's how we dance in Senegal. I was trying to put you on game. I could snap with much tude. Or maybe I could blame my moves on dizziness. Y'all know I suffer from vertigo. That's why I had to get low. I practiced my take-me-seriously face in the mirror as I prepared for school. But when I got to class, my fears were never realized. Instead of being called out for not being able to dance, I became known as that smart girl who dropped it to the floor at LaCura's party. People who went to the party only talked about how much fun they'd had, leaving people who hadn't made it to regret missing it. Not only had I made a huge deal about how my dancing would affect my social reputation, but I had also neglected to realize that a lot of my fellow students weren't even invited. My invite automatically made me cool. My moves didn't kill my rep. If anything, my antics only served to briefly boost Lakira's popularity as an excellent party thrower. All order was restored. I had paid my dues and completed my black girl rite of passage. Recognizing this and the anxiety this whole ordeal had caused me, I decided I never had to attend another high school dance party ever again. Not even prom. Now whenever I'm peer pressured to show off my moves, I politely bow out. I don't fit the stereotype. Hair hierarchy. It took me a while to embrace my natural hair. Sure, it helps that natural hair is in now, but even before natural hair was all that, I had, after years of struggle, learned to appreciate the autonomous locks that rest atop my head. I didn't always have a grievance with my hair. When I was younger, our love-hate relationship was 70-30, in favor of love. Hate entered the picture only when my mother would style my tender-headed scalp, rushing to comb my kinks out with a fine tooth as we got ready for school. The hate should have been directed at my scalp for being so sensitive, but in my eyes, my insubordinate hair was to blame. I'd witnessed the white girls in my class manage their hair with ease, the comb flowing through it as though slicing through water. Even the Jewish girls whose hair was white girl curly had Moses strands that seemed to part for the comb to pass. Why did my hair choose to be so difficult? It didn't help that I had to sit on a West African woman's floor for 6 to 10 hours at a stretch as she braided my hair for the convenience of my mother, and as I grew up, for my own convenience. This long length of time would be bearable if every damn West African woman that took me on as a client didn't marathon the Lifetime Channel. If only the sensitivity and empathy that these women shared with the overly dramatic characters on screen translated to how they braided their clients' hair as they twisted and pulled every inch of my scalp with their rapid-fire fingers. Still, until I went to high school and found out how important edges are to the black female community, the 2 to 3 months of hassle-free hair almost seemed worth the time and pain. What love I did have for my hair stemmed from my elementary school, an environment that embraced difference. Being among an ethnically diverse group of friends was great for my self-esteem. I was celebrated for being different, for having superhero hair that defied gravity and recoiled with lightning speed elasticity. My hair texture was the subject of awe, confusion, and probably envy. I loved it. The desire other kids had to touch my hair didn't bother me at all. Instead, I felt special, original. Sure, their hair was easier to deal with, but everybody and their mom had that type of hair. I was different. And in elementary school, different meant better. Part of my identity was tied to the uniqueness of my hair, and I was proud of that. Until I moved to Los Angeles. Moving from a predominantly white elementary school where I had an abundance of like-minded friends to a predominantly black junior high in LA where I knew no one was already an eye-opening experience. But nobody prepared me for the hair hierarchy. If you don't understand how it works, the hair hierarchy rates worth by length and texture of hair. The longer, silkier, and more European your hair, the higher your worth. The shorter, kinkier, and more African your hair, kill thyself. I was taught this caste system by a trio of mean girls in middle school who found glee in taunting me. To them, my insistence on wearing my hair in an Afro puff made me an easy target. Watch out for Joisa, one girl mused. She might take something out of her nappy hair and throw it at you. Middle school girls are cruel. Clever, but cruel. Even now, almost 20 years later, I harbor resentment toward these girls, but I'm also impressed by how funny some of their quips were. As if they used middle school as their comedy lab. In fact, one girl is now an actress slash comedian who actually reached out to me on Facebook a couple of years ago and asked me to be a part of my web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, when it started to gain popularity. I looked at my computer thinking, bitch, are you kidding me? Bow down to the nappy priestess, motherfucker. It wasn't just that I suddenly found myself in the company of mean girls. It was also that it was the mid-90s and styles were changing. Long flowing hair was in and weaves, though still the butt of many jokes in the black community, were rapidly becoming the norm. And as my luck would have it, Braids with burnt ends, a hairstyle I frequently donned, were just going out of style. Still, nothing could have prepared me for the hate and ridicule I'd received for wearing my hair in its natural state. Despite whatever was trending, I couldn't understand why people were so concerned with how my hair looked when it grew out of my scalp. Why was it so offensive? Of course, my sixth grade brain didn't really know to ask those questions or fully understand the history and social implications of my natural hair, so I just handled it the best way I could, by hiding it. Over the course of my middle and high school years, I hid my hair through braids, scarves, thin flat iron presses, and hoods. Anything just to avoid showing my real hair in public. My hair, once a source of confidence, became my burden of shame. My mother was disgusted by my insecurity. "Why do you keep covering your head?" she would yell, frustrated. "Because you married an African, Mom! An African!" I would cry, yell, Full House style in my head, because I knew better. She just didn't get it. For one thing, my mother was light-skinned, and though she wore her hair naturally at times, her softer-looking texture differed from mine. Furthermore, she and my aunt, whose hair was that good, silky Indian hair, grew up during the 60s and 70s when natural hair was a statement of pride and militant activism. The only source of judgment she faced was from my southern grandparents, who couldn't fathom why their daughters wouldn't straighten their wild afros. They didn't have to face the throngs of straight-haired middle school girls or endure the public shunning of cute high school guys. I mean, sure, they were ostracized and brutalized for their skin color in general, but tomato, tomato. My mother didn't know my struggle. I begged her to let me relax my hair like the other girls at my school. In fact, it was at the suggestion of some of my black girlfriend allies that I got a perm. My mother warned me repeatedly that my hair was too soft to handle the chemicals in a relaxer, but I insisted. Perhaps my pleading eyes moved her to let me do it. A few weeks after rocking my fresh relaxer, I noticed that my hair started to break off at rapid speed. I tried to defend my jagged, rough edges to my friends at school. "Dang, your hair is so short," one girl snapped. "That's 'cause I had cut it," I lied as I twirled a strand that came off on my finger. After the deed was done and my hair fell out, I'm pretty convinced that my mother just wanted to say, "I told your bald-headed ass so." I soon realized that I was worse off than when I started. The sad fact that I was willing to damage my own God-given hair before wearing it out in public was not lost on me. By college, I knew that I had deep-rooted hair issues and sought to come to terms with it by experimenting with natural hairstyles. But when I went home to show off my twisted locks, my little brother was quick to tell me that, aesthetically, my hair didn't look right. After college, I moved to New York and started experimenting with weaves. It was like cheating. I could achieve the coveted top tier of the hierarchy while keeping my natural hair hidden underneath. Still, the difference in reception to my new hair was astonishing. Guys who had never and would never talk to me before were suddenly attentive, and girls wanted to befriend me. Having a weave even inspired me to start dressing differently and carrying myself more confidently. Still, the disrespect to my former kinks was blatant. When I moved back to Los Angeles and reunited with my friends, they too were impressed with my new New York look. "Girl, you look fly." Even my younger brother, who had dismissed my college twist, paid me a compliment, the first ever, directed at my physical self. "Wow, your hair looks nice," he said as he opened the door to let me in. A mere change of styles was changing my life socially and opening all kinds of doors that had previously been shut. I became hip to the life in which I had been so desperate to participate. It lasted but a moment. One evening, while unraveling my weave, I noticed the damage done to my actual hair. Not only was my hair thinning from all the underweave braiding, but I also had about 9 different textures going on in my hair at the same time. Curly patches, dry patches, straight patches, thin patches, long patches, short patches. My hair was having an identity crisis. And that was the last straw for me. Who was I trying to fool? Oh, him. I had started dating the man of my dreams back when I had braids. He had been begging to see my real hair for some time. Black men, I discovered, are just as obsessed with hair as black women are. His dating history included various ethnicities, many of whose hair could have been packaged and put on the shelf at a Korean beauty salon. That silky shit. In a flashback to my middle school days, I was worried that by revealing my hair texture, I would drive him away or somehow make him appreciate me less. Having listened to many of my male friends express their desire for girls with long, flowy, or curly hair, I determined that my hair was not desirable, which made me insecure. And if I were to wear my natural hair around my new beau, I'd be vulnerable, at the mercy of his distaste. I wasn't ready for that yet. So I passed off my weaves as my real hair. He seemed happily unaware. When I finally decided to stop pretending and show him my true texture, I realized I couldn't. My hair was damaged and uncooperative. Then one day, when I was in a music video watching mood, I saw that Natalie Stewart, of Flowetry fame, had released a new solo music video. In it, she was bald, and she looked stunning, beautiful, gorgeous. But most of all, she seemed so free. I had seen plenty of bald women before, but for reasons I can't explain, her look made the deepest impression on me at a time when I was already frustrated with the hold my hair had on my identity. If only I could do the same. I first expressed my desire to cut off all my hair via Facebook. The response was all but encouraging. But what if you have a lumpy shaped head? Ha ha ha, you're gonna look so busted. Don't do it! Oh my God, if you do take pictures. With so many strong opinions, the stubborn girl in me was insistent on going through with it. However, before I made my decision, I briefly discussed it with my boyfriend. I'm thinking about cutting my hair, I told him over the phone. Why? Because I'm tired of it. I want to start over and grow it out again. I don't think you should do it. He changed the subject to something else, but I had already made up my mind. 2 weeks later, on a crisp October Friday evening, I drove myself to the salon down the street and walked in. Hey, is your barber in today? I asked upon entering. Yeah, but he's backed up. What you want done? The receptionist asked, her back turned to me. I want to cut off all my hair. She turned around. You want to go bald? Yes. You going through some waiting to exhale shit? Nope, I just want to start over. Okay, go see Keith over there. I sat down next to three men who were also waiting as Keith lined up a customer. Recognizing that this was going to take a while, I texted two of my dearest friends. Me. I'm doing it. I'm at the barber now. Jerome. Nuh-uh, I just got off. I'm coming. Devin. Me too. My friends joined me within the hour and stayed with me as I sat, bursting with excitement and anticipation. 2 hours later, Keith was ready for me. So you just want me to cut it off? He asked, unfazed. Yes, all of it. Cool. And with that, he swiftly took the cutters to the front of my head. Bzzz. As he started to George Jefferson me, I watched my locks fall down to the ground with a brief moment of panic. Was I doing the right thing? I could stop now and just wear a hat for months. But before I could complete the thought, half of my hair was gone. It was time for me to accept my decision. I watched my friend's eyes for any sign of horror. None so far. When it was over, the ladies in the salon and the barber all looked on with smiles. Wow, bald looks good on you. For real, you got a cute shaped head. Not a lot of women can pull that off. I turned to my friends. It actually looks beautiful, said Devin. You look gorgeous, not gonna lie. I thought you'd look ugly as fuck, but wow, Jerome marveled. I smiled and held the mirror up. There I was. Initially, I decided to cut all my hair off as a way to start over and to take a break from the stress that my hair was causing me. Yet in doing so, I found it liberated me in ways I could never imagine. Not only was it a lazy person's idea of heaven, but having no hair showed me how stupid and trivial my insecurities about hair were. Where Samson found strength in his locks, I shed them to find mine. It was one of the best, most life-affirming decisions I've ever made. Now my hair and I are best friends. We formed a new relationship and a mutual respect for each other. I'm learning to take care of her, and I'm no longer afraid to introduce her to my friends. It's the most wonderful feeling in the world to be comfortable in my own healthy hair. Though my boyfriend initially hated my bald head, the sixth grade me would be pleased to know that, contrary to what those middle school bitches thought, he appreciates me as I am. ABG Guide, The Hair Advantage. For the masses, the hair of the awkward black girl, and even boy, is an enigma. Though not generally known, NASA is even examining strands of our hair for space research, as its gravity-defying properties are key to missing answers in the field of aeronautics. Its buoyancy and ability to shrink when exposed to water is also rumored to be studied by scientists interested in underwater living. It's not just appealing to science. Entrepreneurs see opportunity, too. Every day, more and more products appear to cater to the diverse spectrum of our hair. Each new product claims the ability to tame our hair in a way that other manufacturers don't understand. Subscription boxes, forums, online videos, community meetups, and conferences are all dedicated to the mastery of hair. It's a billion-dollar industry. For the awkward black girl, it is important to view hair as the ultimate form of expression, an opportunity to be noticed and/or to be understood. Complete strangers can become allies or even friends due to respect for each other's hair. This can be positively promising. But there remains a sensitivity with our hair when others express unwarranted opinions and questions. Even within the black community, hair adjectives like laid, fried, nappy, jacked, whipped, dry, and snatched are all used to convey approval or disapproval. They are used judgmentally, as if they assess not just hair, but also character, quality of life, and decision-making skills. When dealing with people who pose so-called questions, even as they judge you, here are some foolproof responses. Question: is it real? Thanks to the widespread popularity of hair extensions, this question is no longer asked solely within the black community. Some people are even desensitized to the question. For those who aren't, the proper response is usually, "Is yours?" with a smile. If that person does not relent, you can try, "It's as real as you are bald," with a friendly chuckle. Passive aggression is absolutely appropriate in this instance. Equal offenders: is it yours? How long is your actual hair? Opinion: it's so soft. I wasn't expecting that. A backhanded compliment I receive often, it always begs the silently self-posed question, what exactly were you expecting? Did you expect it to prick you like cotton plants or to feel rough like gauze tape? This usually comes from friends I've let touch it, or whom I've asked to braid my hair, or from chatty hairstylists. The only response I've been able to muster is a curt, "I know, isn't it?" Question: can I touch it? The dreaded question that many with ethnically expansive hair have heard countless times. A simple, "Are your hands clean?" not only infantilizes the request, but it also sends a message that your hair isn't the sheep exhibit at the petting zoo. Should you decide to decline the request, a polite, "I'd rather you not," should do the trick. If you see that the asker's spirit is crushed and you're inclined to care, simply qualify your denial with, "I'm very tender-headed." Opinion: you should press it. This opinion is almost always unsolicited. It is an opinion most commonly held by the older generation in the South, where in certain parts, natural hair is meant to be hidden, not seen. So as not to cause confusion or uproar, a simple "maybe" or "one day" is enough to give them the hope that you'll gain some sense and do something with that hair. Question: how did you get your hair like that? If the question's context refers to a complicated hairstyle, i.e. gravity-defying twists or an insanely thick side bun, this question is acceptable. If this question refers to one's hair texture, i.e., can I make my hair nappy like yours? Or why doesn't my hair shrink when water touches it? Then we have a problem. Because kinkify it is not a readily available option in the hair salon, those whose scalps don't naturally produce such awe-inducing tresses may be confused or uninformed. So as not to exhaust oneself by explaining genetics, an appropriate response would be, I woke up like this. Opinion. I wish my hair did that. Ah, hair envy. There is no proper response to appease those who can't achieve the natural roots. But this admission, especially given the self-esteem threatening history of nappy rejection, is always appreciated. An appropriate response is, thanks. By the year 2100, when the world is even more globally connected, with intergalactic travel common and interracial mixing the default, we can expect less of a fascination with the mystery of black hair. Until then, during your lifelong hair journey, understand that many will want to touch your hair and some will. A number will speculate on its authenticity. Few will care. Consistency is boring. Variety is key. Don't be afraid to try various styles and numerous textures with confidence. Proudly exclaim, I can wear my hair however I want, whenever I want, anywhere I want. The advantages of black hair are infinite. Public displays of affection. While I was scrolling through Twitter, I came across this picture on Instagram that a ponytail-wearing, plaid shirt-donning, braces-wielding teenage girl posted. In it, she smiled happily in the mirror, her room adorned with all the generic decorations that 14-year-old girls fancy. She lay on her bed, stomach down, elbows propped up to pose for her picture. At the foot of the bed, directly behind her, stood her bare, bird-chested, undergarmentless, curly, high-top teenage boyfriend. His penis wasn't visible, well, because they were doing it. Kids these days, gotta love 'em. As social media redefines the boundaries of privacy, and the term public expands to limits that I can't even fathom, one thing remains the same. I don't ever want to see you and your significant other's displays of affection. PDA used to be more or less avoidable, as in, I could just turn my head and walk in the other direction, or leave the dinner that we agreed would be just the two of us, to which you brought your new girlfriend with whom you keep making out. But since a relationship isn't officially recognized by the public these days without an incessant display of a couple's inseparability, here we are, and it's gross and inconsiderate. According to my mother, when I was a toddler, I used to love PDA. Whenever I'd see two characters on screen kissing, I would exclaim, "Look, Mommy, they're married!" Had I employed the same prudish logic in my teenage years, maybe I would have surmised that my parents' marriage wasn't doing so well. They never kissed in front of us, or said I love you in front of us. In fact, the words I love you were reserved for life-threatening occasions, i.e. air travel and accidents, and birthday card signatures. There was no doubt in our minds that our parents loved each other. But if I were to evaluate my parents' love based on their PDA, I think they were just above an arranged marriage. My parents had other ways of showing their affection without openly fondling each other. They joked frequently and often made each other laugh. I think my mom made my dad laugh more, which I loved. Even now, our sense of humor is what binds us as a family. It's how we express love. It's the reason that I sit at the kitchen table for hours at a time when my four siblings are in town and just laugh and laugh. I don't know that I've ever told any of my siblings that I love them, but if anything, my tearful laughter expresses that emotion on my behalf. Perhaps it's because I found other ways to say I love you without saying those exact words that I have trouble saying it now. The words seem so unnecessarily dramatic. I would much rather be shown love than to merely hear the words. Not everyone agrees. Some people won't know it's love until the expression of it is so obvious in public it's displayed on Facebook. Really? If you ask me, your unctuous displays of love should be kept to your damn self. Growing up, the words I love you were a special gift from me to you. I didn't say it often, and when I said it, I absolutely meant it. It was for you and only you at the specific time that I chose to utter it. Then I went to private school in Brentwood and befriended a bunch of white girlfriends who dished out those words as if they were meaningless. Oh my God, I love you. I love you. You're the best. Can I just say that I love you? I would always just laugh it off, unsure of what to say in return, worried about being insincere. I watched as those words turned into public caressing and hand-holding and kissing and groping. It was almost as if they were checking to see if anyone was watching, hoping they were watching. Mini preteen exhibitionists. The first time I was both intrigued and repulsed by PDA was when my younger siblings and I took a trip with my parents to Paris. We were visiting my Tonton Bokar's family and sightseeing. As we walked through some famous Parisian park that I couldn't have cared less about, because I was 10 and tired of walking and developing what would become a lifelong hatred for tourism, I spotted a couple on the open lawn going at it. They were laid out on a blanket as the man kissed the woman's neck and started to disrobe her. She stroked his back, her eyes thrilled and ecstatic. Then as I walk-watched, I swear I noticed her check to see if anyone was watching. Like, look at me in my adventurous sexual relationship. Look at me, everybody! And that, more than the public act of doing it in a park full of kids, was what disturbed and annoyed me most. How dare she? PDA signals a desperate need for outside validation of one's relationship status. Look at how he kisses me in front of you all. Surely he loves me. Don't you wish you had this? How ironic, then, that my very first kiss was a public display of affection. Well, not really affection so much as acquaintance. A shameful display of acquaintance. I don't know how it happened, but I was so proud of myself at the time. I felt so validated. It was the summer after sixth grade. My mother had decided that the school I was attending, Palms Middle School, wasn't enough of a challenge for me. Not only that, but my sixth grade best friend Ashley's mother had decided to enroll her in a private school. When Ashley was pulled out of Palms, I was too. The entire process was just like applying for college, I'd find out later. My mother set up appointments for me at the top private schools, Harvard-Westlake, Windward, Archer, Crossroads, and Brentwood. Once there, I'd interview with the headmasters and charm them with my intellect and vast and worldly 12-year-old experience. Then I'd go back to sixth grade and sit in class, fantasizing about my new, diverse, state-of-the-art future. Much to my delight, I got accepted into all of the schools. I couldn't decide between Harvard-Westlake and Brentwood. But I remember that during my Brentwood tour, a really cute, probably not, I had horrible sixth grade taste, white, brown-haired upperclassman waved to me as he leaned coolly on his desk, a pencil in his mouth. That image of coolness and the potential for diverse love interests solidified my choice of Brentwood. But my mother had toured the schools along with me, and in her eyes there were very few black faces in what seemed like an overbearing sea of white. She feared that my sense of identity would be snuffed out and needed reassurance that I'd be okay. She discussed it with Ashley's mother and discovered ABC. An acronym for A Better Chance, ABC was headed by a short but robust, shiny scalp black man named Michael, who served as the preemptive olive branch between black kids and the private school system. The organization was founded to make sure we didn't get lost in the private school culture, that kids with less fortunate economic backgrounds or kids who were prone to forget that they were black or Latino would always have a place to simultaneously uplift and ground them. This was music to my mother's ears. What excited me most was that there was an ABC summer retreat right before I would begin junior high in the fall. A co-ed retreat in Northern California? What a perfect opportunity to find a boyfriend. This was a must for me. Ashley and I prepared, giddy with opportunity. Except that everyone hated me. With the exception of one girl who hailed from Inglewood, loved chicken nuggets, and was dubbed Cheerful Cherie for her upbeat attitude, nobody thought I was cool. My uncool status was established on the bus ride we took up to the bay. My mother insisted that she, my little brother, 9, and my little sister, 6, would ride with us and take a return flight home. Aside from the designated chaperone, she was the only parent present. But since my mother was gracious enough not to sit near me so as to fully embarrass me, no one besides Ashley knew that the family in the back belonged to me. The trip started off hopeful enough. Ashley and I watched as various junior high schoolers of all shapes and sizes and both genders filled the bus. That's when I saw him for the first time. I tried not to stare as he walked onto the bus. Taller than me, creme brulee colored skin, green eyes, puberty buff. It was lust at first sight. I jabbed Ashley with my elbow. Oh my God, he's so fine. Who? Don't look, he's about to walk past us. Don't look. Ashley looked. Him? He's not fine. He's cute. He walked to the back of the bus. This is going to be so much fun, I thought. Then my little sister got stuck in the bus bathroom and lost her mind. My little sister, who grew up to be a cool, calm, and collected germaphobe, freaked out at the thought of being stuck in the bus bathroom. She started banging on the door, yelling, "I can't get out, Mom! I can't get out!" To which my mother rushed to help her baby girl while everyone on the bus turned in their direction. When my mother failed to get through to her, assuming I'd know more about bus engineering, she called me. "Joisa, help your sister! Joisa!" Ashley fell out laughing as I sunk in my seat, pretending that my name was anything but that which my mother shrieked. Thankfully, one of the young, fine gentlemen sitting near the back came to my sister's rescue and simply and calmly told her to try turning the knob to the left. And presto, the door opened. My sister emerged with tear-stained eyes, grateful to be let free from the grip of the bathroom monster, a level one boss at best. I remained in my seat, mortified. By the time we arrived at Mills College, an all-girls campus, the color had returned to my face and my hope for the trip had been restored. The campus was beautiful and I felt like I had fast-forwarded it to the college chapter of my life. We got off the bus and I looked up at what must have been the most beautiful dorms on campus, akin to freshly renovated, quaint townhomes. As Ashley and I made our way toward them, we heard hand claps. "All right, guys, those are the residence halls for the college students," Michael said. "You guys will be staying over there." Our heads turned collectively as he pointed to what looked like a haunted, abandoned part of the campus that we hadn't even noticed before. It looked as if it had just emerged from the depths of hell. Ghosts of students past were wailing and circling the dilapidated roofs and breathing fire on the tattered exterior. The disappointment was palpable. Michael remained cheery. "This is where the international students stay. Make friends, learn a language." One of the girls we stood next to shook her head. "Dad, they get the Holiday Inn and we get the Motel 6. I cracked up laughing. Later, upon recalling this memory, I laughed again at how our frame of reference for luxury was the Holiday Inn. The Hotel Motel girl introduced herself as Kim. With caramel skin and her hair in a sock bun, which accentuated her beautiful cheekbones, she was tall, thin, and pretty. Next to her stood a girl who had African-American facial features but looked closer to white. She introduced herself in a thick East Coast accent as Taipei. With long jet black hair that she wore partially up, she was Italian and black. Clearly a mix more common than I thought. She had a cute gap between her teeth that actually looked good on her. I had a gap between my teeth that I hated, mostly because my little brother and sister would parody the Gap theme song with "Fall into Joyce's Gap." The most notable thing about her was that she was a lesbian, and I had never met one up until that point. She was edgy and cool. Both Taipei and Kim were 14 going into high school. My best friend Ashley, who I clutched onto as if for social life, was the only reason I was able to get in with these schoolgirls. With her long hair, cocoa skin, puberty boobs, and chinky eyes, Ashley was constantly approached by boys and adored by girls alike. And that girl could dance. She was everything I wasn't, and as such, she fit in perfectly with the cool girls, despite being 2 years younger than they were. When our families were first introduced, we discovered that she and I were distant cousins by marriage. To deepen our bond and solidify the potential for coolness in my own genes, I publicly identified her as my cousin. As we unpacked our belongings in our respective hostel rooms, we were also introduced to Jennifer, a pretty petite girl with an infectious high-pitched squeal laugh who went to elementary school with cheerful Cherie. They would both be attending Brentwood, the same private school as me. Up until that point, I hadn't met anyone else who would be joining me at Brentwood, so I tried to stay close to them. Jennifer was hesitant, but Cherie welcomed me with open arms. We all gathered together in Kim and Taipei's room to discuss the program, our schools, and of course, boys. We talked about who was cute, who was checking for whom, and our personal relationship statuses. Before I could mention my crush, Taipei spoke up. "That boy with the green eyes is really cute. I think his name's Jordan." "Trick what? Don't you like girls?" Ashley and I exchanged glances as I nodded silently. "Joisa likes him too," she blurted. Taipei turned to me. "He's cute, isn't he?" "Yeah, he's fine." "He's a fine boy," I confirmed. "He's Italian and black just like me. Small world." Small ass world in fucking deed. Too small for lesbians to be claiming the most attractive boys at our haunted college, too. But whatever. Then it was only a matter of time, hours even, before the two of them were booed up. That night, at one of our first mixers, they hit it off and started making out. All week. She had won him, and I dismissed the idea of ever having a chance with him. The rest of the retreat was unmemorable until the final dance. It was a semi-formal, but the closest thing I had to that was business casual. My brand of awkward involves fashion faux pas. I wore a long black skirt with a white-collared short-sleeve top. Boom, semi-formal. I had flashbacks to my sixth-grade dance the year before, where dateless and rhythmless I wandered about by myself and decided not to get my hopes up this time around. Ashley was my date, but that didn't mean much as she was constantly being asked to dance left and right, leaving me to wander as if I were looking for someone in the glass door ballroom's completely open space. Kim, Jennifer, and Cherie were dancing in a group on the dance floor, so I joined them. But Taipei was missing. "Where's Taipei?" I asked Kim. "She's on the phone in her room. I think she's breaking up with her girlfriend." "Girlfriend?" I remembered Ashley mentioning that Taipei's phone was constantly blowing up, but neglected to put two and two together. She had been cheating on her girlfriend with Jordan this entire time. I looked around the party with actual purpose this time. Jordan was on the dance floor having a good time, dancing with girls here and there, but for the most part, he was by himself. I didn't have the besties before testies, sisters before misters, values and morals that I hold so strongly to today. Instead, I slowly and nonchalantly started to two-step drift toward him. My butt poked out until I made contact. He smiled and we began free dancing. As we freak danced to countless songs, the rest of the party disappeared. It was like the school dance scene where Tony and Maria first meet in West Side Story, except set to the rapper Luke's soundtrack. As we danced face to face, he whisper yelled a question in my ear. "Do you want to go outside?" "Yeah," I nodded. My heart raced. What were we going to talk about? Had he appreciated my seductive grinding so much that he wanted to break up with Taipei? It would be a first, but it was within reason, as Jordan wasn't the best dancer either. Ashley poked fun at how offbeat his pelvic thrusting was, but I didn't care. If anything, that endeared him to me even more. He held my hand and led me outside. We were so close and I was so nervous. I don't even recall what kind of small talk we made. I do remember him leaning in to kiss me and me kissing him back. It was my first kiss, much less my first tongue kiss, but I was ready and it was magical. I felt like the nerdy heroine in my own romantic comedy. I got the guy. After minutes of making out, we went back inside the party. My face glowing with excitement, I couldn't wait to break the news to Ashley. As I made my way back to the dance, behind Jordan, I was stopped by Michael, the head of the program. His demeanor was serious as he pulled me to the side in his slim-fitted tiny suit. I stood guiltily as he mustered a friendly guidance counselor smile. "Be discreet with your actions," he started. "What do you..." He held his long index finger up and repeated, "Be discreet with your actions. Keep your business private." He then dismissed me. I was embarrassed, but still on a high from my first kiss. I told Ashley everything and she cracked up. "Did he really have to tell you?" Other than Ashley, I kept my exchange with Jordan discreet from the other girls. The next day on the bus ride home, I sat with Cherie, sharing her Walkman and sneaking backward glances as Jordan and Taipei made out in the back. Why couldn't they be discreet? I wasn't mad or hurt, only relieved that Taipei didn't find out about me and Jordan. Once the magic of my first kiss faded away, I realized how stupid of me it was to kiss him in front of everyone, outside or not. Months later, Ashley and I went to catch a matinee at Magic Johnson Theaters at Crenshaw Mall. As we were making our way out, we saw Jordan and Taipei coming in. As Jordan stood by the door, avoiding my eye contact, Taipei came over and said hi. My stomach clenched as I wondered whether or not he had told her about our kiss. She directed most of the conversation to Ashley and then gave me a snide smile as she walked away. It could have been my imagination, but I sensed that she knew and wasn't threatened. I may have had him once, but she had him all the time. I wish I could say I'd learned my lesson, but my exhibitionism didn't stop there. Years later, when I revisited my first love in Dakar, Senegal, to stay with my father's side of the family, my careless PDA almost got me in serious trouble. One night, I convinced my older cousins to accompany me to the club where I first met my boyfriend, Moise. Club Nyani had become super popular since the time we went the year before. Now it was a tourist hub full of teens. Still, none of that mattered to me. I was excited to be reunited with Moise, more on him in African, and his friends. We had been corresponding via email for a year now, and I was so happy they'd be joining us. He arrived, dressed in his best American gear. We danced for an hour as my cousin sat down, bored, clearly doing me a favor. The club was getting packed, sweaty, and hot. He asked if I wanted to go get some air outside. I got a bout of deja vu and thought about Jordan asking me the same question years earlier. We walked up the steep flight of stairs that led to the club's exit. I looked around for my cousins. Not wanting them to follow me, I told them I was going to get some air outside really quickly. After Moise spoke to the bouncer in Wolof, ensuring we'd be able to get back inside, we left the club. It was so much quieter outside. We found an even more isolated spot and started kissing. Surely this was a step up from kissing outside in front of a glass-doored ballroom. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Just as I started getting teenage bold, playfully grabbing his butt, a military jeep rolled up, honked, and shone its lights on us. Surprised and frightened, I quickly dropped my hands. Moise placed his hands in front of me, attempting to shield me from what he surmised would occur. Both soldiers exited the jeep with urgency, long rifles strapped to their backs. "Lanle?" Moise tried to ask in Wolof, a sign of informality. The police weren't having that. They spoke in French. "Qu'est-ce que vous faites?" they asked. "On parle, il faisait chaud en bas. Vous faisiez plus que parler, viens avec nous." The soldier demanded that we go with him. Moise shook his head. I spoke up in my worst French accent. "Monsieur, qu'est-ce qu'on a fait? Je ne viens pas d'ici, je suis américaine." "Madame, vous embrassez en public. Nous faisions pas ça ici. Donc je vais vous amener en prison." "Prison?" I shrieked. Moise tried again. "On savait pas, s'il vous plaît." The soldier stood there and waited. Moise nodded. Panic in my eyes, I told him I couldn't go to jail. Not only did my cousins not know where I was, but this trip already didn't have the same ease as last year's trip because my mother had joined us. My sense was that she had come to spy on me, having heard about Moise last year from one of my aunts. I had to sneakily plan club excursions to see him since he couldn't come by the house, as I didn't want her to embarrass me by asking him multiple questions or banning me from seeing him. Going to jail would not only reveal that I had gone to see him, but it would also infuriate and humiliate her and my family. Moise reassured me in French. "They're not going to take us to jail. They just want money. I have some. Just pretend like you're giving me some money, too." I nodded, furious but relieved. They were harassing us, stupid corrupt-ass military. Moise turned back to the soldiers and gave them at least $40. C'est tout ce qu'on a. He insisted that was all we had. The main soldier nodded his head. C'est bon, vas-y. He signaled for us to go back inside. We thanked him and went back in the club. Moise apologized, pissed off and embarrassed. I started laughing. It was my first taste of corruption and I was astonished that it could affect me personally. I rejoined my cousins as if nothing had happened, resolving that my intimate moments were best left private. African Dad. Hey, Dad, are you free Sunday? We want to take you out to dinner. I pressed send and placed my phone on my cubicle desk beside me, prepared to wait a lengthy while for a response. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. He was busy making his hospital rounds. I went back to my assigned task of making calls to companies we had partnered with in years past, gauging their interest in active charitable giving the next year. Employed by the March of Dimes for 6 months now, I was feeling adjusted but anxious. My boss valued me and my promotion potential was fairly certain. However, my web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, was gaining traction and I was feeling claustrophobic as my window of opportunity to pursue my passion full-time was closing. Scrolling the 10-page double-sided list of Citibank branches, I saw that I had completed only 10 calls so far and they were all hesitant to commit. I hated this part of the job. How persistent could I be when my heart wasn't into it? We were working for a great cause, helping babies, but those babies didn't need me specifically in their corner. My phone flashed. That was fast. Dad. Okay, what for? I smiled and shook my head. My dad barely remembered his own birthday, so this wasn't a surprise. Me. For Father's Day, smiley face. Dad, oh, lucky me. Can I bring my new wife? She wears blue wigs and has long, colorful nails. I held my phone in my hand closely and reread the message. I was amused at first. What a strange joke. As far as I knew, my dad was still in a relationship with a woman I hated. He was very well aware of my ill feelings, so why would he joke about that? I knew he couldn't have married her ass, so that wasn't my worry. My younger brother would know. He had been living with my father since his senior year of high school and always had the inside scoop when he cared enough to pay attention. Hello? His voice was deep with a grogginess that should have been reserved for the early morning as opposed to the early afternoon. Hey, is Dad high? I just sent him a text about Father's Day plans and he asked if he could bring his new blue-haired wife. My brother's voice woke up. Dude, I meant to tell you. Dad, like, had a conversation with me and basically said he's getting old and needs someone to take care of him. He told me he met someone, and I think he got married to this new lady. I couldn't find my breath. What the entire hell? How had my dad gotten married, A, without his family present, and B, without so much as mentioning it to all of us? Well, on the one hand, I tried to be offended. On the other hand, I was grateful that he had apparently moved on from the horrible woman who had caused my family so much pain and anger. Does Mom know? I managed. I doubt it. What would she think? Had he told her? Welcome to my enigma. I have no idea what's going on with my dad emotionally, and I've always been curious, sometimes frustratingly so. I have no doubt where his head is when it comes to our family's material needs. He's a master provider, a champion in that role. Despite occasionally protesting about something being too expensive, he has always been more than willing to give his kids everything they need to succeed and then some. But of all the men I've known, my father is the most lovingly distant. He's affectionate in his own way. I found myself staring at the Love Dad sign-off in the various you need to pay these parking ticket notes left for me at his house, or at the end of the automatic I'm alive email notifications his boat system sends us when he's at sea. Yet I've never heard the words I love you come out of his mouth. Never hearing those words uttered to my mother or my siblings probably affected me in some way before, but only in writing about it now does it hit home. The truth is that I've long wanted more of a relationship with my father, though this wasn't always the case. I initially blamed my mother for the end of my parents' relationship. During my junior year of high school, on an otherwise unmemorable day, they gathered me, my little brother, and my little sister in my dad's cramped home office and blindsided us with the news. "Your dad and I have decided to get a divorce." My mouth opened and I pulled my eyebrows down into a worried frown. The three of us sat shocked. My parents' lives as I knew them flashed before my eyes. I had never seen them so much as fight. They had just celebrated a 20-year anniversary during one of our summers in Maryland. I remember my mother standing before a small crowd of family and friends in our living room, holding a plastic glass of sparkling apple cider, braggadociously telling the story of how my dad noticed her for the first time. I was at a party with friends, and we were all in line for the food, and I remember he saw me and turned to his friend and started speaking Wolof. I didn't know much Wolof, but I could make out some words, and all I heard was, "something, something, something, bachna." The Senegalese invitees laughed as my mother explained to the non-Wolof speakers that bachna means good. My dad laughed and exclaimed sheepishly, "I was talking about the food." More laughter. This was my parents' relationship as I knew it. Now they stood before us, their somber faces staring at ours. I wish they were calling us to berate us for being lazy children, not for this. Divorce never seemed like an option for us, for them. I stared at them both blankly, unable to understand. "Why?" we all asked in some variation. My younger brother started crying, incredulous. "Cultural differences," my mother told us, tearing up. I looked to my father, who nodded in agreement, sadness in his eyes. Why weren't they comforting each other? Then they hit us with the gut punch. "Your dad will be moving out of the house." More tears. What the hell were they doing to us? They reiterated the same mantra that all decent divorcees tell their kids. "This has nothing to do with you. This doesn't change how much we love you. We are still your parents." But my dad looked so sad. All I could think about was how he'd be all by himself. I had always known my father to spend a lot of time in solitude, reading, working, fishing. But I also assumed that he found comfort in coming home to his wife and kids at the end of the day. Who would he come to now? For nearly 6 years of my life, I used to be my dad's favorite girl. I was the only girl, but I translated this term of endearment to mean favorite child, which led me to have very high self-esteem. He'd come home from work and my older brother Malik would come into my room ominously and say, "Dad wants you." Because of his tone, my trip to my father's room would be marked with fear. But then I'd see his warm, smiling face and realize my brother was just being a jealous jerk. At 10, he was too big to do the special task that would help my dad unwind after a long day. "Can you walk on my back?" he'd ask as he lay down on his stomach and, on occasion, fell asleep. And I would, pretending his back was a mountainous excursion that needed precise balance. At the end of his makeshift massage, he'd affectionately send me on my way, saying, "That's why you're my favorite girl." Then 2 weeks before my 6th birthday, my little sister, Elise, was born and my title was stripped from me. I looked at her, sleeping peacefully and prettily in her crib, and asked, "Dad, am I still your favorite girl?" He laughed. "Of course you are. You're favorite girl number one and she's favorite girl number two." I was old enough to recognize that there could only be one real favorite. I would share my title with no one. No sooner than a week after the divorce announcement, my dad moved to a nice luxury apartment with a fancy fountain and a large amusement parkish pool about 15 minutes away from us. His favorite place in Los Angeles was Marina Del Rey, where all the yachts were docked and where he frequently met up with his fishing club. Twice a month, the club would set sail on a large fishing boat and try their luck. My dad's proudest catch was a 50-pound halibut that he and his club members wrestled with for hours. His new apartment was conveniently 2 minutes away from the 90 freeway, which was a 5-minute straight shot right to the marina. We had just started getting used to having my dad under the same roof as us, as he used to commute from California, where he had just opened a practice, to our home in Maryland. And after just 4 years together, we were no longer a solid family unit. During my elementary school years, when people asked me why my dad didn't live with me, I proudly told them the truth. Now, if they ever asked, they would get the answer they expected. Divorce. And I hated that. So I didn't tell any of my friends for years,